First up today, a look back at a signature moment from the Cold War. Francis Gary Powers was an Air Force spy plane pilot in the 1950s and 60s who was piloting a U-2 plane that was shot down over Soviet territory. The development proved to be a great embarrassment to President Eisenhower, who had concocted a story to explain why it was shot down. The U-2 incident ruined a summit between the U.S. and the Soviets. Here to talk about the story of Francis Gary Powers and the shooting down of his spy plane is his son, Francis Gary Powers, Jr. Gary Powers, Jr. started a Cold War museum because of his father's involvement in Cold War espionage. He'll be at the Truman Library at 6 tomorrow evening to celebrate the opening of a new exhibit, Spies, Lies, and Paranoia, Americans in Fear. And Gary, it's so nice to have you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Pleasure to be on.
Well, there's so much written about your father and what happened on that day in May 1960 when a spy plane was shot down over the Soviet Union. Do we have the full story today, Gary, over exactly what happened, or are there still questions that linger out there?
Well, the full story is known, and the truth has been revealed. But the misinformation and the rumors and the speculation continue to circulate around because of the Internet. On the Internet, you'll read that there was a flame out, that there was sabotage, that the CIA intentionally sabotaged the mission. You'll even read something in regards to my father being downed as the result of an encounter with a UFO. All these things are rumors and speculations of the time. The truth of the matter, my father took off from Peshawar, Pakistan, May 1st, 1960, crosses over the Soviet Union's border at about 68,000 feet, flips on and off the camera switches that will take the photographic imagery of the ground below. He's 4 hours into his mission. He's now at an altitude of 70,500 feet. He's over the city of Sverdlovsk, which is in the central part of the former Soviet Union. There's a bright orange flash that lights up the exterior of the canopy. A shockwave hits the plane, pushes it forward. My father realizes that he can no longer control the plane. Something has happened to the tail section. And what we've determined after many years of research and declassification conferences, that a SA-2 missile, surface-to-air missile, exploded near enough to the tail section to cause structural failure. As a result, the nose pitches forward, the wings snap off, and my father finds himself spinning down towards the ground in the wreckage.
So there's no question, Gary, that back in 1960 that he was spying on Soviet installations, right?
That is correct. The U-2 program was conceived of in about 1955 as the direct result of the open skies policy not being accepted or agreed to by Khrushchev. Eisenhower, our president, Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, LeMay with the Air Force, They were all very concerned about the buildup of Soviet missiles and tanks and bombers. There was something known as the bomber gap and the missile gap in the 50s because the Americans thought that the Soviets were cranking these things out like sausages, as Khrushchev would say. And so they wanted to come up with a way to securely identify the military buildup of the Soviet Union without ground agents. So they came up with the U-2 program. It was created in 1955. The first operational flight took place July 4th of 1956. It was successful for the next 4 or 5 years, up until May 1st, 1960, when my father was shot down. But it was not just my father flying these missions. There were some 24 pilots flying these missions throughout the 1950s.
We're visiting with Gary Powers, Jr. Gary, there's also a little question, if I understand correctly, that the Soviets were waiting for him that day when he flew across Russia. Do I have that right?
Well, waiting. There is another rumor that has been circulating that the Soviets had advanced knowledge of this flight. I've not yet been able to confirm that, but I have read several sources that cite it. I believe Penkovsky, it comes down to his story when he was being interviewed and debriefed that came from. But because it was May Day, the very high holiday in the Soviet Union, there was very little air traffic going on. The May Day parade was taking place. People were on vacation at their dachas. It was a very, very festive time in the Soviet Union. So when my father was flying over the Soviet Union on May 1st, May Day of all days, the radars were able to pick up his plane more easily because there was less air traffic.
And one of the things about the U-2 program, it was designed so that he would fly so high up in the sky, I think you said 68,000 feet, that he could be out of the range of missiles and out of the range of other aircraft that might try to intercept him, right?
That's correct. The U-2s would fly operational missions between 70,000 and 75,000 feet.
How high do passenger airplanes these days, Gary, how high do they fly?
Approximately 35 to 40,000 feet.
So half that,
double.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And that your father even survived this crash was amazing to me as well. Again, reading about this again for the first time in a number of years. It's an incredibly dramatic story. When he landed, well, tell us how he managed to get out of the plane to begin with, because it's amazing to me that he survived this thing.
Oh, yeah, he was very fortunate to be alive, and I wouldn't be here had he died in this crash. After being hit by the surface-to-air missile, and this was an SA-2, a new and improved missile.
Again, he wasn't hit directly, though, was he?
I'm sorry?
He wasn't hit directly, though, was he?
No, it was a near miss.
A near miss, okay.
The SA-1 missiles could only go to about 60,000 feet. The SA-2, the new and improved missiles, could reach 70,000 feet. When you throw 8 of them up in the air, close to a plane, lucky shot, wrong place, wrong time, Dad gets shot down. As he's tumbling in the aircraft, in the cockpit, he's trying to get into position to use the ejection seat. He can't. If he uses the ejection seat, he will sever his legs on the way out of the aircraft.
Mm.
As a result, he does the following. He opens up the canopy, which floats off into space, undoes his harness, and is immediately sucked up halfway out of the airplane. He's still connected by his air hose. So here he is, half in the plane, half out of the plane, spinning down towards the ground. Could no longer reach the destruct mechanism, a little button on the dashboard of the cockpit. Realizing he's getting closer and closer to the ground, he breaks free of the air hose, falls free of the aircraft, free falls for about 5 minutes. His parachute opens automatically at 15,000 feet. He parachutes down to the ground, where he's captured, taken into custody, and then turned over to the KGB that afternoon evening.
Did he often talk about those moments and how he got out of that plane, or was it too tough for him to talk about?
No, he did talk about it. He wrote a book about it called Operation Overflight back in 1970. And he would go on a lecture circuit to talk to students and organizations about his experiences. So he enjoyed talking about it. And as a result, was able to give a firsthand account when he was alive as to what took place.
The KGB, as you just mentioned, quickly got a hold of him once he hit the ground. They took him to Moscow. What happened to him there?
Yes. When he reached Moscow, May 1st, 1960, he's put into Lubyanka Prison. Lubyanka Prison is the infamous KGB prison, part of and adjacent to the KGB headquarters in downtown Moscow. He goes through 1 week of interrogations before it's publicly announced that he's alive and well. During that first week, he's lying to his captors, holding back as much information as possible, leading the authorities, the KGB, any way he could, you know, holding back as much information as possible. But then, on May 7th, Khrushchev announces to the world that they had shot down an American spy plane. And as a result, the Eisenhower administration authorizes a cover story that an unarmed weather research plane may have accidentally strayed across the border after the pilot had radioed trouble with his oxygen equipment. Once that cover story was in place, Khrushchev comes up 2 days later, announces very gleefully to the world, "Ah, comrades, not only did we shoot down the plane, but we also have captured the pilot, Francis Gary Powers, who's quite alive and kicking and who's confessed to spying for the CIA." So this is what this climate was back 54 years ago.
Your father was held for how long, Gary?
A total of 18 months in captivity and 3 months in solitary confinement when he was first captured and going through the interrogations and the trial. So 3 months solitary confinement, 18 months captivity, 21 months total.
Hmm. An interesting little factoid here. I was going to ask you if this is true or not, but that Gary Powers, before the flight, was given a fake silver dollar that was modified to hold a needle of saxitoxin, if I'm saying that right. It's a toxin found in pufferfish and other shellfish as a safeguard against capture and interrogation, meaning I guess he had a way to kill himself if he was captured, but he didn't do it. Why not?
Well, that's correct. The pilots were given the option of taking this type of device with them. It was explained to them that if they were caught and captured, that they would be tortured. This was the mindset that the Soviets would do to any prisoners that they caught. And as a result, it was an optional device to take and then an optional device to use at the pilot's discretion should he need to alleviate the pain and suffering. My father, on this particular flight, did opt to take this poison-tipped needle with him in this hollowed-out silver dollar. It was either dipped in curare or shellfish toxin. I'm not sure which one, and I'm still trying to determine that. But the pufferfish, that's the correct fish for the shellfish toxin. And had it been used, it would have shut down the central nervous system. It would appear that the pilot had died of asphyxiation. The cover story that the U.S. government put out at the time said that the pilot had radioed trouble with his oxygen equipment. So the cover story went hand in hand with the pilot using this device. However, no one told the pilots what the cover story was. There was never any official orders to use this device if captured. It was an optional device to take and an optional device to use. So the left hand really didn't know what the right hand was doing. And as a result, my father lived through this experience. He was captured. It was an embarrassment to the United States at the time, and it showed our military leaders that the Soviets had improved their weapon system to shoot down the U-2.
Did he consider killing himself at that point, given what he might have been up against?
Yes. While he was parachuting down to the ground, he did consider using this device, but he thought that he would wait to land to see how he was treated. He could always use it shortly after landing if he was being tortured or run off by the locals. He could use it as a weapon if he could try to escape, and if he was injured in trees or he was bleeding out, again, to alleviate the pain and suffering, he could use it that way as well.
I should point out that your father wound up, he died in this country piloting a helicopter for an NBC TV affiliate in California. You were 12 when he died, and you've written, Gary, that you were confused about the reaction that his death received. Again, you were 12 years old. What do you recall about that?
Well, it was a normal childhood for me, for the most part. My dad was a pilot. I knew that. I was aware that he had been shot down over the Soviet Union and imprisoned in exchange for a KGB spy. But as a kid, I thought everybody's dad had gone through something like that. That perception changed on August 1st, 1977, when my father died in a helicopter crash while working for NBC Television. At that time, we were welcomed home by a house full of people who informed my mom and I of the bad news. Lives were turned upside down. A burial of my father at Arlington National Cemetery. Everything happened in a whirlwind. And all of a sudden, I was introverted. I was confused. I didn't understand why the press would call the house to ask questions, why friends at school would come up to me and tell me something that they knew about my father.
You didn't have a sense that he was famous in any way back then?
Well, I was aware he was well-known. I was aware he was on TV. I was aware he was a quote-unquote celebrity because he was involved with the NBC television flying their helicopter report on news, weather, and traffic. But again, I didn't understand the significance of the event he went through in May of 60. As a kid, I just thought, you know, it was normal. After his death is when I realized that not everybody's dad goes through something like that.
You know, what was it about his death, Gary, that you know, has caused you to spend so much time researching the Cold War and even go as far as to start a Cold War museum?
Well, having grown up in this family, I was very well aware of the Cold War. It's something we talked about at the dinner table. When I moved to Virginia in 1992 to further my education and also to get to know my family in Virginia better, I started giving lectures to high school students in Fairfax County about the U-2 incident. 9 times out of 10, I'd walk into a history class to talk about the U-2 incident. The students would give me blank stares. They thought I was there to talk about the U-2 rock band, not the U-2 incident. And so that was the catalyst to create the Cold War Museum, not only to honor my father and preserve his history, but to honor all of the men and women who fought, sacrificed, and died during this time period.
I noticed that there's this new exhibit opening up at the Truman Library, Spies, Lies, and Paranoia, Americans in Fear. And that's what's bringing you to the Kansas City area and Independence at 6 tomorrow evening to celebrate the opening of this new exhibit. I know you're going to speak there as well. But I think I've been told you've lent items to the exhibit as well. What did you lend?
That's correct. A variety of items from my personal collection. A couple things from Dad and a couple things that I've collected over the years. We've got one of my father's letters from prison that he wrote home to his wife. We've got a few souvenirs that he's brought home with him, like a nesting doll and a little, a carved figurine. We've got a couple of espionage items, a hollowed-out spy bolt, a hollowed-out coin, two spy versus spy figures from Mad Magazine, as well as an SR-71 model and a piece of the SR-71 airplane, the record-breaking flight that flew from California to New York in about an hour and 6 minutes. And then we have a piece of the U-2, very small, about an inch wide or an inch diameter. And then finally, we have a U-2 film canister from one of my father's flights over the Eastern Bloc countries in 1956.
Where is the wreckage of that plane? Does it still exist or not?
Yes. The wreckage of my father's U-2 plane that was shot down on May 1st of 60 is on display in Moscow.
In Moscow.
At the Central Armed Forces Museum.
Have you seen it?
And the last time I was there was 2010 for the 50th anniversary.
And the Soviets still hold it up as something that symbolizes a big victory over the U.S. back in the day.
That's correct. It is one of their primary displays in their military aviation section, and it honors those brave Soviets who fought to shoot them down, as well as the wreckage of the plane that resulted from the shootdown.
I'm wondering about how your father is regarded today and how he was regarded in the years after he was shot down. Because, again, just reading about this, you know, he was hailed in some quarters as a hero, but in some quarters as something less than that. And I'm wondering why. What was the ambivalence that was directed at your father and what caused that, Gary?
Right. Well, back in 1960, you have to remember the height of the Cold War in the 50s. McCarthyism, the Red Scare, the Red Menace, the Sputnik, all this stuff had happened, and there was this propaganda going back and forth between the countries. So the fever in America at the time, coming off the heels of Joseph McCarthy, was very hot. And as a result, my father being shot down, a lot of misinformation was circulated around. They thought he defected. They thought he landed the plane intact. There were rumors and news reports that he had been seen drinking Russian vodka shortly thereafter at a Russian bar. So there was all this concern that my father had defected, spilled his guts, told the Soviets everything he knew, or hadn't followed orders and committed suicide, all of which were mistruths, innuendos, and speculation of the time. It's taken 50-plus years to help set the record straight. Part of that was done through the creation of the Cold War Museum to help set the record straight. 1998, there was a declassification conference hosted by the CIA and the Air Force that helped to set the record straight. In 2000, the 40th anniversary of the U-2 incident, Dad was posthumously awarded with the Distinguished Flying Cross and a special medal from the then-director George Tenet from the CIA, the CIA Director's Medal. And then finally, in June of 2012, just 2 years ago now, a year and a half, my father was posthumously awarded with the Silver Star by the U.S. Air Force. So even though the truth is out there, the declassification conferences have happened, my father has been awarded these medals for valor and heroics during the Cold War time period, the misinformation continues to circulate around. So, I mean, we're very happy as a family that Dad has been honored. The Air Force and the CIA came up to the front forefront and helped to recognize his contribution. And we're just very proud that the record has been set straight now.
And it sounds to me as though, Gary, that you've been determined to make this happen yourself.
Well, I did have a part to play in it. I did write letters and get some people to help support letter-writing campaigns. But it really helped that the declassification of these documents took place. And as a result, researchers were able to find out the truth as to what took place with my father's shoot down. So that is really what opened the door for my father to be recognized and awarded these medals.
We're visiting with Gary Powers, Jr. We're talking about the Cold War and his father's shooting down by the Russian, by the Soviets back in May of 1960. If you have questions for Gary Powers, Jr. about this signature moment in Cold War history, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also email us to updatedate@kcur.org, or you can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Again, 816-235-2888 here. How was your father received? How did he feel about the reception he received when he came home, Gary?
Well, when my father returned home, he was shocked to discover that there were Americans out there who thought he was less than a hero, that he had done something wrong. But my father really was the type of individual that didn't let things get under his skin. He knew that what he had done in the circumstances he found himself in was the right thing to do. And he was often quoted as saying he would do the exact same things again, given the exact same set of circumstances. So for my father, it didn't bother him that there were these rumors and speculation going around. He went on with his life. He continued to be a pilot, first with Lockheed, then with radio and TV stations out in California. So for my father, he didn't let it bother him. It was just something he had gone through, and he knew that what he had done was correct.
I'm wondering if, as you watch the developments over in Ukraine with Russia and that sister nation there, if you're thinking to yourself that here we go again, here comes the Cold War times two.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's Cold War 2.0.
Yeah, right.
Now, another thing, though, did the Cold War ever end? It was transitioned. It's the war on terror now. But really, the Soviets and the Americans, the Russians and the U.S., it's always been a little bit of confrontation, peaceful coexistence, saber-rattling, and diplomatic diplomacy and maneuvering. So it's interesting to see how history does repeat itself. And what's happening in the Ukraine and Crimea with Putin is reminiscent of what happened under Stalin when he did invading of other countries and took over Lithuania, Latvia, Ukraine, and things like that under the Soviet sphere. So it's interesting to see what's happening. Now, you have to remember, though, back then, everybody was really, really afraid of nuclear war, MAD, mutually assured destruction. In the 50s and 60s, not everybody, but many people were building bomb shelters to protect them and their families from a nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been some talk recently about World War III. I don't see this escalating to World War III. I think that there's saber-rattling, there'll be diplomacy, there'll be sanctions, but in the end, Putin will take over and control the Crimea. It will become a new country, and eventually over, you know, 3, 4, 5, 7 years, eventually the United States will recognize it.
You know, is it too much to suggest that had your father not been shot down on May 1st, 1960, that the ensuing summit, the summit meeting that was planned between the Soviets and President Eisenhower and the U.S. administration, that summit might have been more successful at thawing relations between the two countries and essentially thawing the Cold War a little bit, because there was some sense that that was, you know, a possibility at least at that time.
Well, it's hard to play the what-if game.
Yes.
But had the summit conference gone on and been successful, and Eisenhower had then visited the Soviet Union later that year as he was scheduled to do, like Khrushchev had done in 1959, there would have been a little bit of a thawing of the Cold War. But I still believe that the Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba would have still have happened, and I believe that the Cuban Missile Crisis would have still have happened, but the results could have been dramatically different.
So maybe expectations for what that summit might have accomplished were a little bit overblown.
Correct.
Yeah. You know, President Eisenhower was humiliated in this incident involving your father. Walk us through that. What was the degree of embarrassment? Because I think he said once in the midst of the entire Francis Gary Powers episode that he wished he could resign. It was just months before his administration was going to come to an end anyway, but it clearly weighed on him and took a toll.
Yeah. Well, you have to also remember, and especially for our younger audience, President Eisenhower, a beloved president, a grandfather figure, a World War II hero to our country, helping to win World War II, now president of the United States. And for him, it was a big embarrassment to him and his administration that the U-2 incident happened. It ruined the summit conference. It showed him to be caught embellishing to the American people and the world public. And basically,
embellishing. He flat out lied.
He lied.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But as a president, I was trying to be kind.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
Show respect, you know.
Yeah.
So he did end up taking full responsibility for the U-2 program and the U-2 overflights of the Soviet Union. During his press conference, he called it a vital but distasteful necessity in order to avert another Pearl Harbor. So for him, he thought that the risk of having a plane shot down outweighed the risk of a nuclear war. He wanted to make sure that he knew what the Soviets had, their strengths, their weaknesses, their buildup. Were they building missiles and bombers like sausages? The U-2 program proved that they were not. It proved there was no bomber gap. There was no missile gap.
Mm-hmm.
And Eisenhower was able to use this information in his dealings with Khrushchev and would have used it at the summit conference had it been successful.
And in fairness to Dwight Eisenhower, Gary, he had some reticence about your father's mission and wasn't at least initially inclined to go along with it, again, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, that is another good interpretation. The CIA was in control of the U-2 program, and they pushed Eisenhower just one more flight before the summit conference. If we can just get this information from the central part of the Soviet Union over Sverdlovsk or whatever the military base they needed to overfly, that would prepare Eisenhower better for his talks at the summit conference. So Eisenhower relented and said yes to one more flight, but it can't take place after May 1st. And so on April 29th and April 30th, the weather was bad.
Huh.
May 1st, the clouds cleared. Dad took off. And as they say, the rest is history.
And again, even though your father was flying at 68,000 feet, technology very different in those days, Gary. How clear were the photographs? What could you see what kind of photographs what your father was shooting?
Well, also, you have to remember, though, 68,000 feet was the altitude that he said he was flying, which is published in many, many books. The actual altitude he was flying was 70,500 feet on this mission. And from that altitude, the U-2 cameras would take very clear pictures. You could see parking spaces. You could see the tanks, the missiles, the buildings on the ground. You could see SA-2 SAM missile sites.
That's like 15 miles up in the air, Gary.
Correct. And also, now this is 1950s technology, so imagine what they can see now. Today, they can see golf balls on greens, very clear.
Hmm.
Back then, they could see very clearly the golf course and the putting greens, but not the golf balls. It's just been improved to that extent over time.
You know, Gary, as the years have passed, you know, I'm wondering if there are things today that you wish you had a chance to ask your father about, questions about what happened that day, questions about how he was treated, that you'd love to know about?
Well, I was always curious as a kid as to how high he was flying. I now know that. But as a kid, I'd pester my father, and I'd always ask him, Dad, how high were you flying? How high were you flying? And he got so aggravated that I wouldn't give up asking that question. He told me, well, if I tell you and you tell a friend and they tell their parents and the parents tell someone else, I'm giving away secrets. So I can't tell you, but I would continue to pester him. And he finally turned to me one night before he tucked me into bed and he said, Gary, I wasn't flying high enough. Now go to bed. So, you know, that I've asked him questions when he was alive. I've asked my mom and family questions after his death. But if there's just one question I had to ask him, it'd be more personal. I would want to find out more about him and his life prior to the Air Force and what it was like growing up on the farm and why he decided to be a pilot when he was 12 years old and more personal things. I've read so much about the historic stuff that I'm pretty well knowledgeable on it, but it's the personal aspects of his life. When he vacationed in Cuba in 59, I'd love to find out more about that.
Mm-hmm.
How he met his first wife, how he met my mom, what he did with his friends when he wasn't flying planes. Those are the type of questions I would like to know.
Gary Powers, Jr. is our guest. We had this question from a listener, Gary. How was your father treated in prison? Was he ever mistreated or tortured?
Yes. During his incarceration and his interrogations, there was no physical torture, but there was a lot of mental anguish, sleep deprivation, bright spotlight, grueling questions, threats of death, but no physical abuse.
Tell me about your museum. Where is it located, your Cold War Museum? Where is it located, and what's there?
Yep. The Cold War Museum, I founded in 1996 to honor all Cold War veterans and preserve international Cold War history, also educate students about this time period. It's located at Vint Hill, Virginia, 40 miles from Washington, D.C., on an authentic Cold War historic Army base. Vint Hill was used for signal intelligence during the Cold War. It was used by NSA, CIA, ASA, Army Security Agency, and other groups that were interested in listening to communications from abroad. So it's an authentic Cold War site. The building we have is about 2,000 square feet, full of items from the Cold War period, from 45 to 91, items from United States military liaison mission, items from the U-2 incident, the SR-71 program, civil defense and duck and cover, as well as espionage items like the mailbox used by Aldrich Ames to contact his Soviet handlers. So we have a very wide variety of Soviet, East German, Eastern Bloc country, American uniforms, flags, banners, regalia, as well as items from specific events and activities that took place during the Cold War. Similar to like the USS Liberty, the USS Pueblo, we have a prisoner's uniform from the USS Pueblo. We have a a sailor's uniform from the USS Liberty during those incidents. We have a Stasi prison door and cot from an infamous U-boat, quote-unquote, that was the nickname, Hohenhausen prison in East Germany in Berlin. So, I mean, these are all type of things that we have collected over the years to help preserve this history, honor the veterans, and educate students on this time period.
Gary Powers, Jr. will be at the Truman Library at 6 tomorrow evening, Thursday night, to celebrate the opening of a new exhibit, Spies, Lies, and Paranoia, Americans in Fear. And, Gary, so good to have you, and good luck on your trip over here to Kansas City tomorrow.
All right. Look forward to seeing everybody at 6 o'clock tomorrow. Thank you so much.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.